If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret, searching for the sound. This is the Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
Before we get to today's show, I wanted to tell you all about the new SoundStream app. It is the new home for all things sound podcast, and now you're able to listen to the perfect blend of music you'd expect from us 24/7. Jam bands and more, much more. New episodes of the podcast arrive at least 3 times a week, and now you can listen to your favorite artists and bands all the time in a perfect music stream. Just hit the play button and away you go. You'll be boogieing in no time. You can make requests, offer shoutouts, and even let us know when your birthday is, all from the SoundStream app. Get the app at thesoundstream.com or in the Apple or Google Play Store. The show starts now. We'll be right back. You've been listening to Let the Music Take Your Mind by the Grey Boy All-Stars with Fred Wesley off their 1994 debut release, West Coast Boogaloo, which will be re-released August 7th on Light in the Attic Records. A quarter century since releasing their debut, West Coast Boogaloo, the Grey Boy All-Stars are set to release their first record in almost 7 years, Como de All-Stars. The title track is everything you'd come to expect from this jazz and funk outfit with their Boogaloo blend. While there is some timely chanting on the title track, which we'll get to in our interview with Robert Walter of the band, make no mistake, this band is still the Grey Boy All-Stars, with even greater musical chops and prowess. I can't tell you how excited I was when I got notification that the new single existed, and indeed, when I followed up and listened to it, I was giddy dancing in my condo. So it is with that I tracked down Robert Walter, the keyboardist in the outfit, to talk about the decision to put out new music, even though they aren't the once active touring band that they were in their heyday, with each member moving on to more full-time jobs. And that is exactly where the conversation started, when I asked what the impetus was for the new record.
Well, you know, we do still play some dates every year, but we don't do a lot of extensive touring, but we'll play some festivals and we go down and play jazz during Jazz Fest in New Orleans every year. And then we'll do little tours in the West Coast and Colorado, you know, just like sort of limited things. We'll go out for like a week or 10 days. And we've been doing this for years. And sometimes we just feel a need to freshen up the set list. So it'll be like this to get together and write some music. So this one kind of happened in a funny way where we were out on the road in Texas. I think it was Dallas. And we were supposed to play outside, like an outdoor venue, and there was rain. There's too much rain for the show to go on, so the show was canceled. So we're all sitting there, like, what are we going to do? Hang out in a hotel in Texas for a night off, or why don't we rent a space and some instruments and work on some music? So we kind of just, it was kind of just circumstance that we had the time to do it. So we got together and we wrote like about half the record in that one night, right there. Carl recorded it on his phone or something, and then we could remember what we did. Then we came back and did another very similar, real quick session where we just went in for a day in a room together and worked on stuff. And then we had some tunes, so we decided to go record them.
It is that organic kind of feel to the record that makes it so special and probably felt a lot like West Coast Boogaloo in many ways, right?
They're very similar, and I think that was kind of by design. Like the last couple of Grey Boy All-Stars records, and I know these things happen sort of like there's always like five. This one's been 7 years. There's always like a lot of years between them. But the as time's gone on, we've gotten a little bit more ambitious with our recordings, and there's a few more overdubs. Things are a little more conceptual. You know, the last record had some more like synthesizers on it, and we'll have guests sometimes. So I think the idea for this one was to kind of go back to our roots and try and capture what's great about the band as a live entity, and do it really quick and dirty, and keep all the mistakes and keep it like real minimal on the production, underproduced, I like to say.
Well, it's not underproduced because each of you bring a certain amount of production expertise to the table, and have obviously recorded with so many different people that you have a second sense, sort of what sounds good. But also, you're each so well aware of each other that probably adds a lot to the table as well, right?
Yeah, there's something really mysterious to me about why that group has the chemistry it does. It's even we don't spend as much time together as, you know, I would with a lot of other bands I play with, but there's something just about it. I think we kind of grew up musically together, and we became fascinated with sort of a certain genre and group of records all at the same time, and we really loved it and changed everyone's life. So I think it's kind of a thing of like, you know, whatever, you go to summer camp at the right age with the right group of people, and those people are your friends for the rest of your life or whatever. So I played more hours probably on stage with a lot of different groups, there's something when we come back to that, it always just works, and I know everybody. And then we also all work separately in other like side things. I work with Carl a lot. I work with Mike Andrews a lot on film music. So we're sensitive to each other.
So you press play on Como de All Stars, and it opens up with this hard charging tune, The Skipper. And it doesn't sound like you guys have skipped a beat or anything has changed in the last two decades. That rhythm section is hot, and in particular, the repartee between you and Carl is there's no way to describe it, really. It's so excitable and it's so perfect. Is that something that is innate at this point? Like you say, you do know each other and you are like brothers at this point. Is it just innate, or is that something that you kind of have to work through?
There was a thing where, so like when we first started, Carl was our elder, you know, to a certain degree. He's a few years older than the rest of the band, and he had been a kind of a pretty accomplished jazz musician. He had released a bunch of, you know, jazz records. Those are actually great if you can ever find them. I don't think most things are out of print, but he had made a few sort of like straight up, you know, jazz with acoustic rhythm section records. So, and I was just learning about that kind of music. So I was like, oh my God, this guy really could do it. And he had played with Lenny Kravitz. I saw him on MTV. So I really looked up to Carl, and he played leagues better than me back in the West Coast Boogaloo time. You know,
right.
I was just trying to keep up, but I told him, I said, one day I'm going to be able to compete with you. Like, I'll be able to hang and we could play solos against each other. I'm going to put some fire under you. And so that's been my goal for the whole time. He's like always like the sort of the thing to chase as far as, you know, knowing how to do that. So as time has gone on, I've gotten to feel more like his contemporary instead of his student or whatever. Not that I still look up to him, and he's still somebody who, like, I learn a lot from every day, but I feel like I can hang now. So, and that's kind of happened over time. So we have like a friendly competitive thing, I think, going on.
The truth is that the record doesn't open with The Skipper. It opens with the title track, Como de All Stars, which, and I don't know if this is obviously coincidental, but I can't think of a tune that is more apropos for the time. Is that what made you guys sort of decide to release that single right now, or had this been planned?
It was funny. We wrote that way before, sort of like the you know, this is from a couple of years ago when
right.
that was written. So it wasn't in response particularly to these things, but these are all ideas that everybody's been thinking about for years. And we also, you know, I'm a big fan of sort of all those message records by, you know, Curtis Mayfield and Marvin Gaye, and this one's more similar to something like Simonde, because it's not so much a vocal tune, it's like an instrumental tune with a chant or
right.
a shout. But it's the original idea is to release, but there's only two tunes with vocals on them on the album. We thought maybe it'd be cool to do that because there's something about the human voice that always makes things easy for people to relate to, and I like the idea of a group vocal. It feels, you know, it feels like something cool. So anyway, so that was the original idea. Plus, it's just, we started messing with the sort of Caribbean influence. I mean, it's not actually literally anything that, it's sort of our impression of this sort of more percussion, you know, that stuff sort of brings the party and the dance floor to it. So the idea of making like a song with a message, you know, that's vaguely political, but also keeping it dance floor friendly, so that it's like a joyous thing. So anyway, so that was inspiring. So we had talked about releasing that as a single anyway, and then it just kind of happened to fit in perfectly.
Executive Party, you flood. There's all this negative space in the record. Well, there isn't anymore because there's tons of this Hammond B3 that appears. Is that when you're at your best, when you're in front of a Hammond B3 and you can do all of these fun things as opposed to other keyboards or, you know, other synthesizers and stuff?
You know, I started as a pianist, and I still always feel like I'm that's where my roots are. So when we first started Grey Boy All Stars, we couldn't afford to bring a B3 around. So I just bought a Fender Rhodes, and I got the little 54 key, the little tiny one. And we actually used to check it like it was a suitcase at the airport. And I brought that thing all over the United States, just like checking it and come down the thing. And it worked amazingly after being beat up by, the airplane baggage thing. But anyway, so originally it was like Fender Rhodes, but I started loving all these organ records at the same time. And little by little, we got more of a touring infrastructure, and we could bring a B3. And then I really fell in love with it. So, you know, at this point, that's the thing I feel I can sort of sing on a little bit more than all the other ones. It does have that. It's more like a vocal or like a horn. You know, you can sustain notes forever. It's got this big sound. There's a lot of tone variation in it. So I really fell in love with that thing.
You mentioned keys, and I think in Les Imperials, that certainly comes through with the keyboard runs, and again, you sharing, this time, playing over the guitar riff. But that song is probably the feeling that people get when they think about the Grey Boy All-Stars. I mean, it's a hangout between friends all gathered round, and you're all taking turns, but the probing keyboard run is certainly up there. Is it fun for you to...
That song does remind me of the old stuff for some reason. It's partly because of the sax and flute double and the melody, too. That's like a real sound that I associate with sort of the first album and that period. So that was not by design, but it just ended up really reminding me of the old stuff, which is cool. And that keyboard on that track is an RMI electro piano, which is kind of a deep cut.
Yeah, it is really deep cut.
Keyboard. It's sort of barely, it's kind of broken too. but I always loved those things when you hear Sly Stone, like there's a ride going on and all those, the pianet on that and how like kind of cracky and broken it is. I love that kind of detail in the record, vintage gear, you know.
You know, I ask a lot of people, we've had, you know, Marco Benevento on the show. We've had other keyboard geeks on the show. I always ask, because I'm fascinated personally by the Fender Rhodes. There's something about music between 75 and 78, maybe, that is some of my earliest memories of music growing, like I was a baby. But I still, there's something about the Fender Rhodes that feels very warm to me, even though it's obviously not the warmest instrument. And I'm curious from your perspective, what is your favorite keyboard or synthesizer to play when you're just, you know, aside from piano, because obviously that's the favorite, but what is sort of next favorite?
Like Hammond B3, of course, but then Fender Rhodes. And, you know, those are the piano, Rhodes, you know, organ, clavinet, maybe, and I love Wurlitzer pianos too, and it's different. But the Rhodes, that was when we first got one for Grey Boy All Stars, I'd never really played one, and I just loved. I felt like everything sounded good on it.
Yeah,
you didn't even have to work that hard. It's just such a beautiful thing. I think, you know, some of it from like being a kid, and my parents would watch Taxi, and you'd hear the great Bob James theme to that, and
right,
super great Fender Rhodes moment, and it just like it really hits me in a nostalgic place that I love from '70s, and then it's also just really rich in overtones. You know, like Gil Evans had even said that, the great arranger, said that the Fender Rhodes is kind of the most orchestral.
Really. You know?
Miles Davis started using a lot to sort of emulate some of those Gil Evans arrangements. Duke Ellington had one famously.
Wow.
At the end of his career, he didn't record that much on it, but that was the thing. It's just that it's nice to play harmonies on.
It's amazing to me that more bands aren't using it now or aren't experimenting with it now. And I guess it's because it feels dated to people. I don't know, but it's just, to me, it is.
It is sneakily on a lot of things that don't sound so traditional Fender Rhodes. I mean, if you really put it out front, it does have a 70s connotation, but you can use it within things in a lot of different ways. It's sneakily on more records than you think, well into the 80s and even 90s.
Right.
And then, you know, now everybody's just using software versions of it. So most people are recording a lot of music that's, you know, more digital based. But the Fender Rhodes, samples of Fender Rhodes end up in things usually as a double or buried within something. But it's kind of a universally graded sound.
Do you fool around with it? I know Marco spends a lot of time modding it, so to speak. Is that something that you do, or is it just you? It is what it is.
I'm a pretty much off the rack guy as far as Fender Rhodes. Like, you know, there's a whole movement in the 70s and 80s where you would, you know, dyno the Rhodes, which I'm not exactly sure all of what happened there,
right?
In a technical way, but they're like there's more blown out EQ wise and a bunch of other things. But I always loved the sort of straight up traditional sound. I actually prefer the earlier models to like the sort of early 70s ones.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be slightly darker in tone. You know, I like Thrust and Headhunters, Herbie Hancock.
Right,
you know,
right.
That's the,
of course.
My ideal Rhodes. You know. So, but I do use a lot of effects on it. Like, I am into that, and that comes from Herbie,
right.
Who used a lot of Echoplex on it. You know, you'd use envelope filters, different sounds like that. I use distortion box. You know.
It's so
I
cool.
I like all that kind of stuff.
You know what? Like sincerely, like if I could learn an instrument and play it even a little bit, it would be the Fender Rhodes, because I love the sound. And it's funny, and just anecdotally, I remember the story that Adam McDougall told me, is that when he got his first Fender Rhodes, they were clearing them out of the music store. They wanted to get rid of them. And so he was lucky enough to get one because they were on sale, or they were just dumping them or whatever. And
when most of us got into this, like even I started like in the early 90s, those instruments were very out of style,
right.
You know, and everybody was trying to get new things that were lighter and could do more tricks. And they were like, why would you carry this giant heavy thing to the to your gigs? And, you know, which sometimes I ask myself still, because that vintage gear is like crazy to haul around. But there's something about it that, you know, it's electromechanical, so it's got a little more nuance, and every one of them's got its own personality, and they're, you know, just more fascinating. But I was lucky enough to get into that gear before it became super expensive, and now it's more collectible and it's more popular and all that.
Getting back to the record, Born Into Space is this psychedelic haze, and Warm Bliss is different. It's more of a southern rock thing from way back.
Warm brass.
Yeah.
That's sort of a tribute to this sort of like folk funk records that we like where like everybody had like sort of a funky beat on their record at a certain point in the 70s, even if it was a country artist or a sort of folk person, or you know, all the rock records, everything had a pocket. And, we always were fascinated with the sort of those rarities. So that's sort of a version of that, and has like some real songwriting stuff going on. Mike Andrews wrote that song, and he's a brilliant like song person, where that's not always what we do, where it's basically a groove band, but we're into that too. It's cool. Write a chord progression once in a while.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I think maybe, and I could be wrong, but everybody was trying to make disco records, right? I mean, that's why
what it eventually became. Even before that, there was this thing where I just think that sort of infected the music. Like everyone loved that there was more interesting rhythms coming out. But yeah, eventually it became disco, which is actually a great beat. It just, the only thing about disco that became a drag is it was so ubiquitous. That everything, it'd be like, you know, putting trap hi-hats on your record a couple years ago. Everybody right. did it on every kind of record, and you're just like, okay, enough with that. So, one beat, like George Clinton said, that's a great one of the funk beats, but once every record was that same beat, it became a little bit tired.
Right.
But I definitely love some disco records.
is the mission to preserve the heritage of jazz funk, or is it to empower other people, influence other people to sort of grow to this music on their own? What it is the goal of the Grey Boy All-Stars at this point?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, when we first started, it was really an appreciation society for a certain era of records that we thought were underappreciated. So, you know, at the time when people thought about funky music, they thought about maybe James Brown, P-Funk, you know, Stevie Wonder, these sort of the big icons of the scene. And we were like, well, there's all these great sort of records by jazz artists where they're using these rhythms and these forms, but they're improvising on them, and there's all these, like, and then also rare funk 45s that people weren't really hip to at the time. And so originally we were kind of like a tribute to that. We're like, we write some of our own tunes, but we'll play a lot of these people's music, and hopefully people get turned on to these great records. And then eventually we lived in that music so much that it became, I think, authentic to us. Rather than, we started as imitators. We started as like, oh, we're going to try and do this, make a Lou Donaldson record. But it turned out to be like, we became some of this, and some of our own experience that didn't relate to that became part of it. And I do think if you care about keeping that music alive, it has to become contemporary to the people that are playing it. I don't mean by mixing it with the modern genres or something like that. I just mean people have to, it's a living, breathing thing. People are creating it now.
Right.
And I wanted to be part of that tradition, not just someone who appreciates that tradition. I wanted to eventually become one of those people. And I think over time, I feel like I have contributed to the thing. And we are part of the conversation if you talk about that genre, along with, you know, other people that are contemporaries of ours, like Soul Live and Galactic, and, you know, a lot of people have sort of put their own little stamp on this thing. Lettuce, you know.
Yeah.
So you know, Matthew Martin Wood, it goes on and on. All these people have sort of like, they've kept working with this within this sort of larger genre and added their own contributions, and it becomes, you know, we are the tradition.
Yes.
Also, you know. So.
Do you think it helps that the jam band community, and I hate pigeonholing people, but do you think that because you were embraced by that community, you and Soul Live and Lettuce and Galactic, that it sort of helped that your contemporaries sort of have a place in to play festivals and to bring your music to larger audiences, that you aren't, you know, doing these things for hundreds but you're actually doing it for thousands of people?
Yeah, I mean, it was the only place that there was really an audience that was receptive to that. When we first started Grey Boy All-Stars, it was more about this dance music scene, you know,
like the hip-hop time.
Yeah, they call it acid jazz, and it was more related to hip-hop and jazz-informed hip-hop and all that stuff. But that was a club scene, really, and it was kind of fickle, and things changed in that genre. It's much more based upon the newest and latest and trends kind of go. So that's where we started. We had no idea that people who like the Grateful Dead would like our band, but for some reason we started to play these events and then we were shocked. Like people would, they had the ear to listen to a 7-minute solo,
right.
You know, or God's sake, a 30-minute solo.
Yeah.
And then we were interested in music like that already. You listen to like Grant Green Live at the Lighthouse. The songs are long and they're jamming and they go, you know, so it fit right in with what we were doing. And we were like, I can't believe all these people are willing to sit through these long improvisations. And it sort of allowed us to just be us. And I think for that audience, it was a fresh take too. You know, like they did a lot of the things they were looking for, but with a different perspective. So it's really been a blessing. You know, for years we kind of loathed being considered a jam band. We're like, we're more related to like jazz and soul music, but I don't know. I never want to like not be thankful for the audience, you know?
Right.
So it doesn't matter what they want to call it. as long as people want to come and listen. You know?
I think more than anything, it's the appreciation of the art form, right? I mean, most deadheads or fish heads or whatever, I mean, the real passionate ones who are passionate about their bands, they're passionate about music, and that's why they're in love with the bands that they love. And so it makes sense.
Also, very loyal audience that goes for years, and people like don't. It's not like a thing they're into when they're in college.
Right.
People stay engaged in the music forever. So that's a great audience. The only downside is that sometimes your association with, you know, what you would think are like hippie bands or jam bands can scare off people who are would consider themselves more jazz fans or indie rock people or things like that that probably would like our music, but there's sometimes it's got a little bit of a stigma.
Right, I get it.
You know what I mean? Like, there was, it's going to be some big lot scene and it's, you know, whatever, it's all about drugs and, but you know what I mean? Like, there's a certain vibe to it. But I think that's being erased as time goes on too.
Right, I think
there's... Now it's kind of cool for indie rock bands to like Fish and the Grateful Dead, you know?
Right.
Something happened there. Where it used to be very opposed aesthetically, you know.
How much of the playing that you do with Grey Boy enters into 20th Congress or even the work that you do with Gordo? How much of that feeling enters into... Now, obviously, things are planned a little bit more for Gordo because these are songs and they have a start and finish, and who knows if you're deeply involved in the writing of those things. But how much of that... Boogaloo inspiration or acid jazz inspiration, whatever you want to call it, how much of that appears in, I think less so in probably 20th Congress, but in playing with Gordon, who is such a musician's musician, how much of that sort of style shows up?
It's always like where I come from, mm-hmm. those kind of influences. And that's the thing I can excel at. Like, I feel real comfortable if we're like in a funk thing, or if it's blues based in some way, if it's based on sort of the more classic American, Black American music traditions, that's gospel and all that stuff. I feel like very, like that's my wheelhouse more. And then like with Mike's band, things are go there, but there are also some harmonies that I'm not as familiar with that are more based upon like sort of rock songwriter things where it's you know, triads moving around. I can't do all my fancy jazz voicings.
Right, right.
It's just inappropriate to the music, and that's something I had to sort of get my way around. But it, you know, it's an interesting challenge. But those skills always come up. I mean, the thing that all those great soul jazz records and stuff like that taught me is playing, how to play rhythm and how to play in a rhythm section and how to make the music feel good. So that's always the priority. Even if the music's really sophisticated, we're playing at an odd time, if there's, you know, if it's some very sort of exotic form, I still try and always make the thing feel good, you know. Right. Not necessarily is it always dance music even, but it has a rhythmic flow and it's something that you can sort of feel in your body, which I got from, you know, funk records, really.
What's going on? I mean, you're obviously the world has sort of put a halt to everything, unfortunately. What are you doing to sort of keep up with the chops and plan for the world getting back together? Like, what are you up to on a day-to-day basis kind of thing?
Well, I mean, luckily it happened to be that there's this backlog of all this music that we've sort of been waiting to release. So we have the Grey Boy album. I have an album that I made with Eddie Roberts and Adam Deitch as an organ trio that's going to come out.
Wow.
So there's and then, you know, there's the reissue of West Coast Boogaloo, and there's like all these different projects that are sort of coming out. So there's music to release. And then I've also been working on, I was kind of preparing to do a solo piano record before the pandemic, so I had been working on that. So it's given me a great time to practice mm-hmm. on my own, because that's something when you're always working for the next gig and preparing these things, you don't always get a chance to sort of attack your weaknesses as a player and the things you feel less comfortable with. and it's given me all this time to sort of just play the piano in my house. So I've been learning more about old stride piano and boogie woogie piano and these things that I've always loved, but I've sort of slacked on in recent years because I was always off playing a gig. And then I'm also writing music in a sort of homemade electronic way and trying to work on like a funky record, but it's, I play all the instruments. So more like, you know, my version of a Stevie Wonder, Sugi Otis kind of thing, you know, without the vocals, obviously, but, you know, like me playing all the parts, and something I've always been interested in, and I've always demoed my tunes that way, but I'm trying to use the sort of limitations of the time to create something that's kind of about this experience rather than, you know, I don't want to just sit here and wait for it to be like it used to be. I'm trying to like take this time and make something that sort of is about doing this. So,
and you're not writing any
solo stuff,
odes to COVID-19 or anything like that. Like that's the biggest fear, right?
It's not that literal. Yeah.
the biggest fear is that when this is all over, every musician is going to release their ode to,
yeah, everything's going to be about that. But I do think it's a nice time to just dig into like, what could you do without being able to be in the studio with other musicians or live with other musicians? Right. What can you do with your creative energy?
So cool. Thanks so much for taking
watching every movie ever. I've watched every movie ever.
Yeah. I've been cycling through. I finished Seinfeld. I finished Larry Sanders Show. Like I'm thinking of, you know.
Which other one can you watch? Yeah.
Yeah, I guess Cheers maybe is the next one. Or Taxi. That was
good. I started that. It's pretty good, actually.
Really?
It holds up.
Oh, yeah. Excellent. Thanks so much, dude, for taking the time. Speaking of things that hold up, I mean, Grey Boy All-Star, so excited that I, as I said, I mean, it was a visceral reaction. And I sort of jumped the queue and I went right to management instead of to the publicist. And I felt so crappy about it afterwards because I was so psyched. But thanks so much for the record. And please thank everybody else on my behalf for the record. And it's great, too, that you're releasing West Coast Boogaloo because new people, new fans need to hear the old school stuff, too. So congrats on a great new record and certainly preserving the music. We appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
What a terrific discussion with Robert about the Grey Boy All-Stars and, of course, about Como de All-Stars out July 3rd. I'm fascinated by the approach and the musicianship as a band and the genre bending that they do. For more on the release, visit greyboyallstars.com. Before we leave you, have a listen to the title track from the new record, an important one in these times we find ourselves living in. Here is Como de All-Stars.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.